From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we continue our look back at 2016, this time in the Latin America Caribbean region, with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo. Tony, welcome. A pleasure, and it's been a little too long.
Yeah, thanks, Don. It's good to be back talking to you again. And there's so much to talk about what's happened over the last year and what the likely outlooks are for 2017. Maybe we should get started straight away talking about Argentina, because I have difficulty remembering the big events earlier in the year. But the one event that I do remember was that your man Mauricio Macri took office in Argentina after winning the election the previous November. And very much as predicted, his policies, his right-wing neoliberal austerity policies, have been a disaster for Argentina.
Yep.
And so, and also that economic repression has been accompanied by signs of repression of civil and political rights, especially in the case of the indigenous activist Milagro Salas, who's I think her sentence has either just been issued by the court in the first case against her, because there are a couple of cases against her, or it's about to be issued, and there's been a lot of attention around that, because the case against Milagro Sala is regarded internationally as a kind of litmus test of the good faith of the right-wing government in Argentina. And all the signs are that they're not going to pay any attention at all to international public opinion that has been expressed, for example, in recommendations by the United Nations organization that Milagro Sala be freed, and also by, and I think even Luis Almagro, the Secretary General of the Organization of American States, has spoken out against the imprisonment of Milagro Sala. And at the same, in parallel with that issue, there's been the judicialization of politics in Argentina,
yeah.
which is a theme that we can come back to in relation to other countries as well, yeah. With regard to former President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, who either yesterday or the day before, she was actually indicted in this case that is very, very clearly a put-up job. And what the right-wing authorities in Argentina have done is they found themselves a right-wing judge who's prepared to treat this trumped-up case against Cristina Fernandez as if it were real. And he's now indicted her. So she now has a case to answer. And, of course, the background to that is that there's no way that Mauricio Macri and his cronies could possibly win another democratic election. So what they're trying to do is break up any potential opposition by any means necessary, whether that means phony judicial processes or outright repression, because they've also been extremely aggressive in repressing labor protests against the mass unemployment that's developing in Argentina as a result of the government's policies. So that's very much gone the way we originally thought it would back earlier in the year.
Yeah, well, it seemed inevitable. I mean, we said that essentially the dissatisfaction that allowed people to, enough people to stay home and allowed Macri to be elected in the first place was only going to be exacerbated by the policies of a right-wing government. That has happened. The people are have been in the streets almost since a year ago in December.
Yeah.
And he's playing a pretty dicey game, too, because as he looks to find mechanisms to keep unpopular policies in power, or keep a government implementing unpopular policies in power, he's going to essentially help develop more and more aggressive resistance, and it seems to be bearing out already. I'm wondering if he's going to make it through 2017.
Well, and he probably will. And one of the interesting things about Macri is that he's in politically, he's an extremely shallow figure. You know, and he's got, there's no depth to the political program that he's trying to impose on people in Argentina, and that's the way he sold it back in the election. And it was impossible to pin down Macri on exactly what he was going to do. And he just said, oh, well, in general, things will be better. And that was basically his political platform,
right,
apart from attacking on entirely false premises the record of the governments of Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner and her predecessor, her husband, Mr. Kirchner. And so, now he's going through the motions of, what do right-wing governments do when things go wrong? Well, they fight among themselves, and they make a few cosmetic changes to make it look as though they're trying to address the crisis. And that's what's happened in Argentina over the last few days. Macri sacked his economics minister, his economics and finance minister, a guy called, quite appropriately, Pratt Gay. this kind of somebody very much associated with the Wall Street financial culture,
yeah,
and trying to impose those ideas on the Argentinian economy in the hope that somehow, as if by magic, the free market will kind of summon up economic prosperity. It's just so stupid, isn't it?
Well, meanwhile, you've got, the thousands and thousands of people that he fired and laid off and that are unemployed, the many thousands of people, they still are unemployed regardless of whether he changes economic ministers or finance ministers or whatever. And they know it. Every day they wake up and they're angry over it. And so unless he's going to address the discontent that his policies are creating, he's going to have to. I don't understand how he governs otherwise.
Yeah, and I think that's very much going to be a theme throughout 2017, not just in Argentina, but throughout the region, in particular in Brazil.
Yeah.
And of course, what happened in Brazil earlier this year was this slow motion coup against President Dilma Rousseff, which was a combination of corporate media attacking the government, allegedly for its economic incompetence, and doing everything it could to kind of embroil Dilma Rousseff and the former Workers' Party president, Ignacio Lula da Silva, in spurious charges of corruption that in fact ultimately gobbled up the very people who were accusing them, the head of the lower house in Brazilians' parliament, a guy called Eduardo da Cunha, turned out to have been deeply involved in the corruption, and he's actually in jail now.
Right.
And that's a motif that also affects Argentina, because Mauricio Macri, of course, is up to his eyes in this Panama Papers scandal,
yeah,
and it's turned out that he's been deliberately deceitful about his and his family's involvement in offshore companies that have been involved in decapitalizing Argentina.
Right.
Some commentators regard the legal proceedings against Cristina Kirchner as a kind of smokescreen to give some kind of cover to Mauricio Macri for his wrongdoing. That's a theme that it will also play out through 2017, how the corrupt right wing actually get caught up in the processes that they themselves have abused against left-wing political leaders.
Yeah, and if you look at Brazil as an example for Argentina, not only do you have some of the very people that impeached Dilma Rousseff being carted off in handcuffs and off to prison, but you also have the figurehead that they put in power running with 3% favorables. There's just about no one in the country, I'm wondering how his family feels about him, has a positive view of Temer.
Yeah, and President Temer himself is deeply embroiled in the corruption scandals that are currently working their way through the Brazilian courts. And it's extremely unlikely that he'll come out of it clean. But one of the important things to remember about Brazil is that slavery was only abolished there. It was the last country in the Western Hemisphere to abolish slavery, 1888, kind of 25 years after the American Civil War.
Right.
And that, you know, and that, if you look at the right-wing Brazilian elite that is now governing the country and that has just railroaded through the legislature with, you know, I say railroaded, in fact, they had quite enthusiastic support from a lot of the right-wing deputies in the Brazilian parliament. But they pushed through the Brazilian parliament a measure freezing spending on social programs like education and healthcare and stuff like that for 20 years. And that is completely insane.
Yeah.
You know, and why are they able to do that? Because they're a tiny elite group of white people whose lives have nothing to do with the great majority of the multicultural society that Brazil is. And so they're immune or isolated. They've completely isolated from the reality of ordinary people in Brazil. And it's when I saw that was passed, I thought, this is insane. That is, even politically, no, why would you do, it's like political suicide for the Brazilian right wing. And I just, when one looks at that, well, how do they think they're going to get away with that? And very similar to what's happening in Argentina, a mixture of repression through the judicial system, control of the media. But even that, and it's just impossible to see how that's going to work.
Right. Well, you know, Brazil, I mean, you mentioned the diversity. And also the fact that Brazil was the last country in the Western Hemisphere to abolish human slavery. The population of African Brazilians is a majority of the population in Brazil.
Right.
It's been 5 years now, so.
You know, and it's going to be interesting to see how things work out through 2017. I'm not entirely sure that. And Mauricio Macri will not make it to the next presidential election. I'm almost certain that Temer won't in Brazil. I think he's bound to have to leave office before, unless, of course, the Brazilian elites wangle some kind of process to bring forward the elections, which is perfectly possible.
Yeah, but you know, the people don't sit still for this stuff. There were some fundamental changes that took place in both Brazil and Argentina over the last 10-15 years during the times of both Nestor Kirchner and Cristina de Kirchner in Argentina, and both President Lula and Dilma Rousseff in Brazil, where, you know, millions of people were lifted out of abject poverty, and now they're headed back that way. And people tend, once they're given a meal or two, they tend to want to eat.
I know. I mean, that's just so obvious, isn't it? I mean, and across the region, and that's why I over the last year in our conversations, I've always argued that, and this so-called conservative restoration is entirely fake, because it's built on sand, and it's built on the false premise that there's some kind of right-wing political agenda that's sustainable, and there isn't.
Right.
You know? And so, through 2017, we're likely to see the process that you just mentioned, whereby people who were enabled by progressive government, the policies of progressive governments in the region, they were enabled to get a taste of a decent life. And then now they're being shoved back down into the dirt. They're not going to put up with that.
Oh.
No, and so there are various different. There's so many different expressions of that, and not just in Latin America either, are there? And up in the United States as well, there are very strong expressions of, for example, indigenous groups no longer accepting that their land can just be taken from them. as we saw with that Dakota Pipeline protest, right, which is, unless I'm mistaken, is still continuing.
Yes, it is. Even in, they've had blizzards and 50-mile-an-hour winds and stuff there, but the people are hanging in there. And also, I mean, we saw expressions of that across the United States, both for several years now. People have been in the streets over police killings and police brutality, and a whole host of issues that were raised in the context, you know, of people being organized around those first two. And also, the essentially, the working class uprising that we saw in the electoral sphere that lifted Trump to the Republican nomination and almost lifted Sanders, who people were calling a socialist, regardless of what he is, quite remarkable, right, in the United States, almost lifted him to the nomination for the Democratic Party.
Right. Yeah, and so, and the 2017 is going to be a crucial year, isn't it, for the, to see whether it'll be possible for popular movements across the Americas to consolidate their resistance to the right-wing policies that it seems to me are a sign of the desperation of regional elites, as they see their power and influence and control and status slowly decline and they begin to evaporate, faced with the global competition from rivals like not just China but principally China and also Russia. I think that's going to be one of the key motifs through 2017, the development of popular struggle against ever more desperate right-wing elites trying to hold on to their power.
I think the closest, the thing closest to home for the United States is Mexico. And we've seen constant turmoil there. People were in the streets for a very long time over the student teachers that were killed or disappeared. And a number of other things that happened, including just recently, there's a major increase in the price of oil as they've been privatizing Pemex. You know, while Trump is building a wall and trying to get a check out of the government in Mexico, whatever instability that might create in Mexico, the objective conditions there are ripe for some sort of substantial fundamental change. And, of course, with that being the largest country in Central America and sharing a border with the United States, that could be very important, as could, you know, you don't know how much stock to put in it. Trump said, no more regime change. Now, you have this Monroe Doctrine, which, you know, arrogates unto the United States government the right to do whatever, and that has included regime change both in soft coups, some of which we've been discussing, and outright military occupation. And I'm wondering how that's going to play out. Also, in the context, if they look to not have confrontations with Russia and China, certainly China wants to do business in that region, and they've made heavy investments already and promised much more, if we're going to see a whole new relationship develop there, and what that means for the game on the ground between the left and the right.
Yeah, and one of the huge questions for Latin America, Latin American economies in general, is are they going to be able to diversify their economies away from the supply of raw materials to giant customers like China, because that's what they need to do in especially in terms of poverty reduction at home. Right. They've just got to diversify their economies, and that's very clear. You know, it's one of the very clear themes that comes out of the studies and reports by the Economic Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean. So, and whereas it's certainly possible to kind of sustain a certain level of prosperity and increase levels of prosperity and reduce poverty by means of the Latin America's traditional export of raw materials to the rest of the world. And the fundamental change to overcome poverty, and that's one of the things that the government here in Nicaragua is insisting on, is a diversification of the economy into all kinds of productive activities that enable the country to escape being entirely dependent, for in Nicaragua's case, on production of food products. And so, and you can see that also in Venezuela. And the crisis in Venezuela that developed all through 2017 had a lot to do with that. The model of dependency on rent from petrol, rent from oil, just broke down completely, went with the collapse in the oil price. And so now the oil price is recovering a bit. But the interesting thing in Venezuela is that Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues have managed to negotiate the crisis, the economic crisis, at the same time as they've been diversifying the economy. And it remains to be seen how successful in 2017 their efforts at diversifying the Venezuelan economy away from abject dependence on income from oil production, the oil market, will have been. And it's encouraging to see that the oil price has recovered to, and I think it's up around in the early 50s now, which is great news for Venezuela, and should enable the government of Nicolas Maduro to enough breathing space to recover to get ready for to have a serious chance of winning the elections in 2018. And it's still not clear in Venezuela whether the opposition are going to be able to organize themselves successfully to force some kind of readjustment to the political system. And I think that on balance, it looks as though Nicolas Maduro and his colleagues have reshaped their economic policies and sustained their social investment policies in such a way as to enable them to get through 2017 with sufficient political capital in terms of voter acceptance and acceptance of their social and economic policies to be able to do well in the elections in 2018. We'll see.
Yeah, well, one of the dialectics with, and again, this can relate back to U.S. interference. I mean, President Obama signed an executive order that listed Venezuela as a threat to U.S. national security. Obviously, that wasn't just rhetorical. That enabled a bunch of activities that certainly involved some of the economic sabotage that Venezuela faced over the past few years. And I'm wondering what, again, if you can put stock in even the words, but what it means to say that there's not going to be any more policy of regime change, if that means that Venezuela will be left alone to find its own way and perhaps even engaged as a partner to sit down and discuss and negotiate with. But absent all of that, the interesting dialectic has been that as the right wing and as the oligarchs tighten the squeeze on the economy, it forced the hand of Maduro to actually, get more aggressive in terms of moving towards socialism in some areas, including in the distribution network. And that's kind of a dynamic that's lying in wait, if it's not present already, around the region.
Yeah, I think in 2017, people in Venezuela are likely to get more and more fed up with the right-wing opposition. Because the opposition in Venezuela offer nothing positive. They aren't even capable of sustaining a dialogue with the government to try and reach some kind of accommodation. And that's extremely negative from the opposition point of view. People in Venezuela they may not be entirely positive about the government's policies and the government's policy responses to the crisis that has been generated, as you said, largely by foreign intervention. And that's been the case ever since the earliest days of the Bolivarian Revolution under Hugo Chavez. But there was an interesting interview with a guy who used to be one of Chavez's lecturers. I can't remember his name now, a former general, and he's in his 80s now. But one of the interesting things that he said in a recent interview was that the popular Venezuela, the Venezuela that is moved by its kind of political unconscious, if you like, and to use that term from psychology, the natural consciousness of people in Venezuela is Christian and Bolivarian, and he left out socialism. But, and that in itself means that, and if he's right, and Nicolas Maduro has a natural tendency towards support that the opposition don't have, because the opposition, and what are they trying to do? They're trying to recycle the political reality pre-Chavez, which is, you know, completely counterproductive.
Right.
And politically, they have no future. So, and I expect that in 2017, the Venezuelan opposition will steadily weaken and become even more divided than they already are, allowing the government to recoup political ground throughout the year.
And we've go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to start talking about Colombia, but have you got something else to add to that?
Yeah, on Venezuela. Yeah, just, you know, to remind people, and we've discussed this a few times, you know, there are at least 1 million families who have new modern apartments as a consequence of the Bolivarian Revolution that are, you know, that's something like 15% of the entire population that are not going to go quietly into that good night just because the right wing says so. And, you know, there are constituencies like that that have been built across the country and across the region, with people being lifted out of poverty and given some dignity. And I don't think they're going to let go of it very easily.
This motif is, we'll see it develop through 2017.
And so, yeah, we've got the Colombia peace process, we've got the passing of Fidel, we've got the opening of relations somewhat with Cuba and the United States, and, of course, the huge victory for Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua.
Yeah, and sticking with this idea that Trump may change U.S. foreign policy in Latin America, I don't think he will. I know U.S. foreign policy in Latin America has been the same for something like 50 years, longer.
Since Monroe. And,
and Manifest Destiny and all that.
Right, that's right.
And it's just, and that mentality hasn't gone away. So I don't think we can expect any spectacular change in Trump's foreign policy with regard to Latin America. And indeed, if there is any change, it's likely to be one of, and as he's already signaled, a slightly more aggressive policy towards, for example, Cuba and any country in the region that resists the United States policy agenda. And of course, the code for a country that the US applies to countries that resist its foreign policy agenda in the region is, they aren't democratic, and we have to encourage them to be more democratic, and we have to promote democracy in these countries where the political system is fragile, or else a dictatorship. So, and you see that we're likely to see that in the case of Cuba.
Yeah.
In particular, whereas for most of us, the death of Fidel was an extremely sad event, but one that confirmed the incredible capacity for survival and adaptability of the Cuban Revolution. And people in of Trump's political persuasion and the anti-Castro Cubans regard that as, now Fidel's out of the way, we can make political progress on our terms. And that's likely to be another theme through 2017, how that right-wing political aspiration comes up against the reality, the very solid reality of the Cuban Revolution.
Well, and Raul Castro just yesterday, Cuba will not go toward capitalism now or ever. And there was a really strong sentiment of that evident when I was in Havana, you know, a couple of weeks ago. So I don't think that that's going to go. We got to pick it up here next week, because we're just about out of time, Tony. But Happy New Year to you, and we'll speak again next week and finish wrapping up the year.
Okay, thanks a million, Tom. Look forward to it.
Same. Thanks a lot. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.